From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Writing of his experiment with life in the woods near Concord, Massachusetts during the middle part of the 19th century, Henry David Thoreau observed that he went to the woods because he wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, to discover its meanness or sublimity, and to publish them to the world. Thoreau's design for life at Walden serves in part to underscore the remarkable flourishing of literature and philosophy that literary historians have called transcendentalism. What were the characteristics of this mid-19th century flowering in American writing? How did these characteristics evolve, and how do they continue into the 1980s? Those questions are central to a forthcoming study by one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. Olaf Hansen is a professor of American Studies at the University of Frankfurt. At the center, Olaf Hansen worked on a project entitled Aesthetic Individualism and Practical Intellect, a project that examines the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, along with other 19th century American writers. Joining in the discussion with Olaf Hansen about transcendentalism is Everett Emerson, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Everett Emerson is the author of books and articles about American literature from the 17th through the 19th century. Olaf Hansen, let me begin our conversation about American literature and transcendentalism with you. I've been searching for an opening line into this conversation because we really have a 50-cent word here, transcendentalism, and a lot of people have difficulty making change on that. What does this word mean for the purposes of our conversation today? How do you define transcendentalism?
Staying within the metaphor, it's not German currency to start with. The idea that American transcendentalism was a direct translation from, let's say, the transcendentalism as we know it from Kant is wrong, and it has been shown in scholarly work that this is not the idea. American transcendentalism is basically a blend of American Romanticism with an enormous amount, I should say, of Enlightenment mixed into it.
How does it come to American shores? Can you give me the short sketch on the long foreground?
Well, it has been on American shores, and what became the transcendental movement, as it was called, or what became transcendentalism for short, in a way, I should think, was a kind of looking backward in order to cope with the future. People like Emerson did what the French call reculer pour mieux sauter. He went backwards in order to cope with questions of the future. So it was a very indigenous, genuine American thing. And the unhappy fact, so to speak, that it was called transcendentalism has created enormous confusions, out of which came a lot of doctoral dissertations and articles. But the way I would treat it is as a American tradition in its own right.
Everett Emerson, let me ask you to consider this. Is it transcendentalism a movement? Is that something that that gets, is that a term that American literary or literary historians use as a convenience?
If so, I'm not happy with it, because it seems to me the word movement implies something more organized than this thing was, this phenomenon, I suppose I would call it, was. I see it as a group of individuals who shared, to a very small extent, similar attitudes and ideas, who had something in common. Now, they did organize at one time. There was the Hedge Club, there was the Transcendental Club, but I think we can overemphasize the sense of organization, because Thoreau, for example, who was one of the important figures in the phenomenon, I don't think is really at all to be associated with anything such as a movement, because he was too much of an individualist.
Can you give me, let me interrupt you, Everett, can you give me some chronological beginning and ending? When roughly does it start?
Well, my guess would be that we would say it begins in the early 1830s, Emerson's address at Harvard, the Divinity School address, and the American Scholar are in the mid-1830s, and it's pretty well dead, it seems to me, by the Civil War. That is, there were some later transcendentalists, but I think of it as lasting roughly from 1835 to 1860.
Now you say it's dead by roughly the middle of the century. What gave it life and what killed it? And by extension, doesn't it live today? Isn't there such a thing as transcendentalism in American literature or the American mindset?
Well, what gave it life, I suppose, was the fact that it met the need of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And what killed it, if it was killed, is that it no longer met the need of the moment. It has to be considered, surely, in historical context.
Olaf?
Well, the irony involved here, I think, is that people like, as I mean, Perry Miller has pointed out this fact quite succinctly when he asked why did people, and then he addresses them by their first names, why did Waldo and Margaret go back to the Puritans at a time when sort of the Unitarians were basically taking over from Calvinism?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the ironies is that one of the needs that these people met in American society was to maintain the integrity of the individual vis-a-vis a growing mass society, vis-a-vis a society that was becoming a society where people like Emerson and Thoreau were afraid that the individual would not count any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do that, in order to be sort of modern in this sense, they had to go back to certain traditional values, which had to be rephrased, however. They could not simply plunder the past and say, you know, we are arch-conservatives and we go back. But they rephrased aspects of the past for their contemporary needs and problems. I think this is the main contribution.
To what extent are you talking about? Well, tell me about the mixture here of politics, what we might today call public policy, as well as the literary and the philosophical. What were these transcendentalists concerned about in American society? Everett?
Well, let me say in the first place, we need to think of these people as almost all of them coming from a religious background. That is, the second generation, the later transcendentalists, different group, but the first group, including Emerson, these people were all clergymen to start with. And so their jumping off place, if you will, was their dissatisfaction with contemporary religion. Their concerns were in part that religion was conceived too narrowly, and so their concerns became much broader, and they became social and philosophical and religious.
Did they feel that religion had failed in America, or that it was the wrong kind of religion, Olaf?
Maybe not so much the religion as such, but as Emerson noted in one of his diaries, I've often thought of leaving the ministry. The office has become antiquated.
Ah, so it was the form.
So it's a kind of anti-professionalism,
yes,
that you detect,
yes,
in these people.
Yes. I would offer a kind of definition of transcendentalism, mm-hmm, that I don't think we had before, and it is that the transcendentalist is the person who said there is an authority that one has within oneself. There is an authority that one has for what one does, which is not tradition, which is not the establishment. And this source of authority within the individual, which I understand to be the basis of transcendentalism, therefore permitted people to feel that they could go on and be the individuals they were.
Well, let me ask you to pause on that, Olaf Hansen and Everett Emerson. Where were the precedents for American individualism that the transcendentalists were worried about losing?
On one hand, there were kind of, I would say, individual heroes who stood out from let's say, from the religious infighting that was going on around Boston. But these were only semi-heroes, I would say, because...
Are you talking about people like Jonathan Edwards and George Washington, or were these not household names?
Much more directly, I was referring to someone like William Ellery Channing, who sort of opened the door, but then again, by Emerson's tastes, opened it in the somewhat wrong direction and sort of not wide enough. On the other hand, part of the... of the attitude of the transcendentalists was not to emulate one particular character, but to be sort of to spread themselves out and, you know, read Greek philosophy, read Buddhism, read Hindu philosophy, and say this is exactly what we try to avoid, namely to find one particular role model, although there were some favorites for Emerson, for example, Montaigne, Bacon, and some Greek philosophers.
At the beginning of our conversation, Everett Emerson said that transcendentalism, one way of defining it, is to say that it existed to meet certain needs of the moment. And yet, here in transcendentalism and its writers, we're talking about Emerson and Thoreau, we have monuments of American literature. And yet, you can hardly say that these are people who are addressing the problems that we live with today. What makes them important in the 1980s? How do you make that that leap from the problems that they faced to the problems and that we face today? Everett?
I don't think there's any difficulty at all in dealing with that matter, with reference to Thoreau. I've been teaching Walden for 30 years, and every time I teach the book, my students respond as though it were written yesterday. That has not been a problem. There's a much more serious problem with Emerson. But what I would say about this is that, for me, the appeal of Emerson is in part that I must find a way to make what he has to say important to today's students. And I'm looking forward to what Olaf has been working on as a contribution towards that end.
Olaf, what about that?
Well, there are two things that cross my mind sort of right away. One would go back to the question of the voice. I was rethinking the two essays by James Russell Lowell I just mentioned, and I wonder whether it makes sense if we compare Thoreau and Emerson to see Emerson, even in his essays, much more as a lecturer than as a writer. Whether it makes sense at all to discover and to see, as Lowell did, who was very sort of close, as far as time spans are concerned, to Emerson, to see in him more like a writing Socrates, to see him as someone who even in his essays talks, which means that the rhetorical figure of persuasion is the one that is the most important one. In fact, I think the distinction is extremely important, especially if we come to the second part of what Everett just said, namely that it is very difficult these days to make people understand the paradoxical way of thinking which you find in Emerson's essays. And the playing with a paradox is an appeal to the reader. And I think one of the main achievements of Emerson's essays is that he makes the reader work. The reader cannot lean back. The reader has to become involved.
In other words, you have to come your half of the field, as it were.
Absolutely.
And work to understand what he's saying.
Absolutely. There is no way of understanding the work of the essays if you only pick one or two nice phrases from them and then say, well, this is the gist of the matter. For anyone who reads the essay history, to come away from his reading with a firm notion in mind, I now know what history is all about, I think, would be very, very difficult.
So we're doing him a disservice when we quote him all the time, Ralph Waldo Emerson, when we make of him a source of tidbits and quotations, words to live by sort of thing.
Well, I'd immediately comment that the reason we do it is that we can't resist doing it.
Uh-huh.
He is full of such quotable statements. I want to quote him all the time. I want to refer to him because he puts things so neatly, so epigrammatically.
Mm-hmm.
In the essay History, I was looking over my copy recently, and I have it all marked up with quotations that I can pull out. So if it shouldn't be done because it misrepresents him, still one can understand why one does it, because he's irresistible.
Isn't this sort of the essential hallmark of the speaker, that the audience, with no text in front of them, goes away and remembers from that long speech 3 or 4 or 5 pithy remarks?
Yes, I would certainly think so.
And I think this carries over into Emerson's essays, which of course we now can read again and again and again, which you can't do with the word, which goes up into the air and then disappears.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about American literature in the 19th century, with attention to Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, two figures who exemplify what literary historians have called transcendentalism in American culture. The Soundings panelists are Olaf Hansen and Everett Emerson. Olaf Hansen is a professor of American Studies at the University of Frankfurt. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming study about American literature in the 19th century. Everett Emerson teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of books and articles about the American Puritans, about Mark Twain, and about American writing from the 17th through the 19th centuries.
Let me ask you this. Does one have to be more or less the equal of writers like this to approach them and to come away from their work with a strong sense of what's actually going on?
Emerson says in his essay on history that readers of Shakespeare's plays who read the speeches of his kings feel that they are equal to those kings in Shakespeare's plays. He makes the point that, in fact, what we discover when we read the great writers, what we discover when we read history, is how much we have in common with people of the past.
So he's making a very positive or favorable assumption about human nature and about his audiences.
Yes, he is assuming what I assume, that if a writer was in some true sense important, he still must be, and that there is a connection which maybe I'm obliged to help students understand.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very strong statement in history, if I remember correctly, where he says that we must, basically, it's the rhetoric of metamorphosis, where he says we must change into someone like Lear, or we learn nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes,
his supposition is that the experience of history is taking the part of the historical personage, and he mentions, I believe, the archaeologist who digs and digs and digs until he discovers that the people who built the structures that he has been unearthing were people like himself.
Right.
Olaf Hansen, Everett Emerson, I realize that as university professors, you shy away from labels. You don't like that sort of thing. But would you call Emerson a philosopher? Would you call him a literary man?
I would like to comment on
Everett?
That. Years and years ago, I had a course at Harvard in American philosophy, and the person who taught the course felt obliged to say that here is this central figure that is an embarrassment to real philosophers.
You're talking about
Ralph Waldo Emerson is a kind of embarrassment, that he is the central figure, but no, he is inconsistent and...
What, he didn't have tenure, is that it?
No, it's not that he didn't have... It is that he was, his philosophy was derivative, that he offered other people's ideas, that he said nothing original, unsystematic, all the faults that technical philosophers would reject. What I wanted to come around to saying is that these days the attitude is different, and it's interesting to me that one of the people who is most interested in and has written best on Thoreau and to some extent now Emerson is in fact a professor of philosophy at Harvard, whose work I think Olaf might want to say a word about.
Yeah, it's Stanley Cavell you're thinking of.
Yes.
So in other words, Emerson has been accepted by the philosophers.
Yes, not only in recent days, where we are much more aware of philosophy not necessarily being a system, but if you go back to the oration that William James gave at one point in time on Emerson, it's easy to detect that philosophers, unless they subscribe to one particular system, let's say they are either Hegelians or they are Kantians, once they are willing to admit that philosophy can be unsystematic in that sense, they are immediately attracted to people like mm-hmm. Emerson. And Stanley Cavell, in his book Senses of Walden, has written magnificently on Thoreau, and in his essay Thinking of Emerson, he has approached the question, to what extent is this philosophy? And
well, if we can say then that men like Emerson and Thoreau are literary as well as philosophical, there's certainly a social dimension there. Let me ask you to comment on this. How are they accessible to general audiences in the 1980s? What parts of their work? The whole thing that they did, should one simply drift through it and you don't want to come away with just a series of quotations, though. What is it that one should look for?
Well, I would recommend some particular essays.
For example?
The essay Experience.
You're talking about Emerson here.
Emerson's essay Experience, it seems to me, is one of the most profound statements of what it is that we experience as human beings in this life. It is a very thoughtful essay from beginning to end, and my experience with students is that the only thing that they don't like about it is that they find it a little threatening to them. It's so profound that it offers more than they can absorb, mm-hmm. but I would highly recommend that. Olaf has mentioned the essay History, which I would also recommend. And these two essays are not the ones that probably have been spoiled by people's having read them in high school or college. Self-reliance, for example, or compensation. I would urge people to stay away from that because it will present Emerson, I am afraid, in an unappealing way. Mm-hmm. Another essay that I admire and find exciting and stimulating is the essay The Poet. Partly because of the connection I would make of that essay to Whitman and Dickinson. But by itself, it is remarkable. One goes from that essay, I regret to say, to Emerson's poetry with a sense of disappointment. But I would also say, give Emerson's poetry itself, apart from that essay, a try. There's some wonderful poetry.
Olaf?
Yeah, I agree, and I don't want to add anything to the canon. I think with Thoreau, we have managed to domesticate sort of this wild creature by having sort of handsome editions, which put Walden and Civil Disobedience into one book, and we have an edition of The Heart of His Journals, it's called. So they are accessible, but I am always a little bit wary when we discuss these people in terms of their accessibility. Of course, as professors of literature, we have to set up a syllabus and a canon and say, well, we want to do this and we don't want to do that. But I think that at the same time, it is our duty to point out that we are always only getting segments of what these people did. And I think Emerson was very much aware of the fact that he was constantly presenting a segment to his audience rather than giving them a whole. I remember a phrase from his Natural History of Intellect, where he says that other people build system and I am contented with dotting points on and fragments on a curve, and then asks the rhetorical question, is this worse than having a system? And of course it's a rhetorical question. The answer is no. So I would always point out to my students that which essays, for what purposes we pick, we can decide, but it will not be the whole Emerson, the same way that you cannot present to a class, let's say, the whole of Goethe or mm-hmm. any great man of literature. And coming back to your original question, how would we label them, you know, philosophers or people in literature? I think the adequate label is men of letters. They are the American equivalent of the homme de lettres, and have to be treated in that way. Mm-hmm. Writing for them was a moral act. It was not something that you did sort of for simple pleasure or because you were making a living writing novels like Balzac, for example. They were men of letters for whom the mere act of putting something down on paper was a very moralistic thing to do.
Was it a political act for them, Everett, Emerson? How much did they have that sort of thing in mind? My sense is that with Thoreau, you would have a stronger case than with Emerson, but tell me about that.
Well, I would say that Emerson and Thoreau were concerned about political questions in the most profound sense, but they were not much interested in day-by-day politics. They were not interested in who was running or whatever. Politics is a great concern to both of them at the highest level, as everything else is at the highest level. I like what Olaf has said about these people as being considered men of letters. I think that's a very good expression for them. Emerson himself points out that one of the results of modern civilization is that man is no longer whole. He's a specialist in this or that or whatever. And Emerson wanted to reemphasize the notion of the whole person. And he himself was indeed a whole person.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the third segment in a series of discussions about American literature. My guests were Olaf Hansen of the University of Frankfurt and Everett Emerson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Olaf Hansen recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming study about American writing during the 19th century. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the short stories of Ernest Hemingway. My guest will be Joseph Flora of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.